Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Supi Seshan. She has lived and worked for 22 years at the Gurukula Botanical Sanctuary in the western Ghat Mountains of India. The sanctuary is a center for plant conservation, habitat restoration, and environmental education, and also a community. In 2006, on behalf of the sanctuary, she won the Whitley Award, UK's top prize for nature conservation. She's an Ashoka Fellow. Her current focus is the restoration of one of India's most endangered ecosystems, the high-elevation Shola grasslands. Well, and apart from which, she's a fabulous writer and a wonderful human being. So first, thank you for all your work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek.
So first, can you tell listeners about your work and tell them about the sanctuary?
Okay. The sanctuary has been around for about 40 years, and it's located in the Western Ghat Mountains in the state of Kerala, and it's on a plateau which is still forested, and they say there's about 33 forests cover here, but that, you know, that includes plantations as well. Now, the work of the sanctuary for the longest time has been the rescue, the search and rescue of native plant species, especially the little ones. A lot of people doing afforestation or reforestation work, or, you know, they work with trees, and that's really important, but very few people have cared for ferns and mosses and liverworts and orchids. The balsams, or the impatiens, as they're known in the West, begonias. There's lots and lots of plant groups that are herbaceous. And these are very vulnerable to habitat destruction. And, you know, when the forests dry out from being fragmented, often it's the mosses that disappear first, or, and there's, you know, there's so many pressures on the forests here. So the place was founded in the belief that the plants are the basis for all well-being, for planetary well-being. And so that's what we've been doing. We've been scouting all over the Western Ghats and going to places that we know will be destroyed or are in the process of being destroyed, and we just pick up these plants from rubbish dumps, from roadsides, dam sites, plantations, burnt areas, overgrazed areas, urban settlements, and we just bring them back, and then we propagate them. And they go through the whole series of gardening techniques, I guess. So we use a lot of gardening techniques, but the intention is to provide a refuge and another chance to survive the changes, the destructions that are upon us. So that's the work. That's conservation, search and rescue, and then rehabilitation of these species on the land that's here. So we care for 63 acres on the edge of a really nice forest that's with the State Forest Department. So the land is in a process of forest recovery, and we live here, and so we also grow some food. We grow an old variety of rice. And then we plant these plants once they've gone through an intensive care process. So that's cuttings and seeds and pot culture and all of that. Then they actually go out to environments that have been themselves destroyed. Say, like, it's been under a tea plantation or coffee. And what we do is we work with all these features of the land here, and we try to grow what's native to the land, but also we choose diversity and rarity over the species that are more common. So we have to do that kind of balancing act, really. We also pull out invasives And then the whole idea is that if we find people elsewhere in the mountains that these specific plants belong to, then we would go back there and work with them, like in a national park in the higher elevation Shola forest. And the whole idea is that we can work with the native grasslands, take away the invasive exotics, reintroduce species, and so on. So that's what it is.
So, I mean, that really is, I mean, the word sanctuary is not hyperbolic at all. It is a sanctuary for these plants.
It is absolutely a sanctuary, yeah. And it's also a sanctuary for frogs and birds and leeches. And in fact, while we speak, you might hear some grunting and licking noises of Polly, who's one of the dogs here, and she's taking care of leech blood on my feet because I went for a walk just before the talk, and it's full of leeches because right now one of the things that we have to look out for is because leeches are actually a sign that the land is in a healthy state, that we have very few chemicals and nasty things happening. But if the monsoon doesn't happen as it should, then the leeches start to diminish in numbers, and that's when we start to get worried, and we don't feed leeches to the fish, and you know, we are very careful with all the leeches around.
And I'm also hearing various birds in the background, so this becomes, you said, a sanctuary for frogs and leeches and obviously dogs and humans.
Yes.
Can you talk about a few of the birds there too?
We've noted over 220 species of birds on the land over the years. So that's quite a lot of birds for 63 acres. And, you know, all the Western Ghat endemics for this area, as well as migratory birds. So we have racket-tailed drongos, yellow-browed bulbuls, the Malabar trogon, the grey hornbills, flycatchers of many kinds, the mynas, just a lot of birds. And, you know, that's been a real joy to be part of, you know, this life here, which is so full of sounds the whole time. You know, it's really rich and alive with all kinds of creatures being very, very busy.
So can you talk more? I mean, we're sort of dancing around the edge of it, but can you talk more about the line you said about how plants are the basis of life? What was it you said? I mean, talk about the relationship between let's say there's some land that has been devastated by clear cutting, by being a tea plantation, and then there's going to be some sort of rehabilitation. What is the relationship between rehabilitating the land, the reintroduction of native species if necessary, and then that becoming a home for animals as well?
Okay, so one thing I want to make clear, Derek, is that we're gardeners and environmentalists and educators. We're not scientists. So anything that I say, in a way, we have our own definition with these terms. And so none of us would be referred to as restoration ecologists because we haven't been trained in the science of restoration ecology, but we all practice ecological restoration. So there are, you know, people all over the world, I guess, who are doing this, who haven't been through the, you know, the science part of it. And there's also distinctions between restoration, rehabilitation, reconciliation, reclamation, all these, you know, words. And what we're doing is we want to bring back health to the land as we perceive it. And the place that we know the best is this area here, this 750-meter high plateau, or this end of this plateau. And
wait,
it's tropical.
Wait, who is that in the background?
I think that was a tree pie we just heard. Yeah, and that's a racket-tailed drongo. and some crows.
Okay, go on.
I had my headphones on, so I didn't hear them.
Oh, sorry.
In the case of tea plantations, which we pulled out thousands of tea plants, and for some time we just left the place alone, and you see different plants coming in and mixture of exotic species and native species. And unfortunately, because we're so limited in space and our intention is so big, our intention is the endangered plants of the Western Ghats. So that's like a 1,200 kilometer mountain chain. And here we have 63 acres that we have some kind of a say in what happens here. So we have to decide that this is an area that's going to be completely left alone. And then we have to decide things like, this is where we want to try if we can bring a grassland back. And that's completely an unnatural process, because this is supposed to be 40 meter high trees, full with lianas and epiphytes and, you know, dark and so on. And here we are trying out a grassland. And the thing is that there are grasslands that are native, natural at this elevation. We have seen places which are very rich in grassland species. But really that it's at a higher elevation that they start to become, you know, prevalent, the grasslands. So we're taking this decision and we go to this 2 acres or 3 acres that we have just bought and taken out the tea. And then we have to start planting, or we have to start removing plants. And those are very, you know, careful exercises where we exchange all this knowledge between us, and we say, okay, so now this has to be a grassland. And then we would have to then take grasses from elsewhere, split them, plant them, having removed the invasive exotics first and some of the pioneer woody species. And then over a period of time, we start to scatter seeds or plant, you know, grassland shrubs or other herbs. And over time, say 10 or 15 years, this becomes a very beautiful grassland. But of course, it's maintained. So we have taken this choice to give this additional chance for grassland species. And at this elevation, we have to do the work of keeping the woody species out. So that's grassland rehabilitation. It's not restoration here. But if we're working in the higher elevation areas where it's completely natural grassland, then that would be restoration work. Has that answered your question?
Well,
I'm sorry.
No. That was a long preamble to the answer, I think, so what I really want to get at is the importance of the relationship between, say, when you do some restoration work elsewhere at those higher elevations or somewhere, what you said is plants are the basis for life. So what I really want to ask is what happens when you help the land to switch from being a plantation or a tree farm to help it return or help it become whatever it is it wants to be. What is the relationship between doing that with plants, between helping plants to reestablish themselves, and then animal diversity?
Okay. So this is our belief, and I have friends all over the country who would say that if you protect the tigers, that the habitat comes back and all diversity will be protected. And I'm not going to argue with any of them, because this has really come about because we really love plants, and every single one of us has been in love with plants, has known plants all our lives. And we've just seen how, you know, they seem to be able to work on places where we have seen a complete loss of anything organic, you know. So you see mosses or lichens. Lichens are a combination of alga and fungi, as everyone knows. You see how they come in into barren places, and for me, that's absolutely miraculous. I'm not saying that animals don't come in, that beetles or, I don't know, other creatures don't come in. But when I see something that's been really barren, desertified, attract or receive the tender care of small plants, I think I've witnessed something that's absolutely, you know, magical. And from then on, the others come in. And if you witness this over a period of time, it's absolutely incredible what happens. Which is not to say that the first thing should have happened. So, you know, I don't want to give that impression that I excuse that I'm kind of like overlooking all these acts of horror. But when you see plants come into a place that's been desertified, and then the whole slow recovery of diversity of species, and then the worms, and then the fungi, and then the beetles, butterflies, frogs. It's really amazing. So we've seen it. We've had the privilege of seeing this for about 40 years, different pieces of land that have been deforested or destroyed. We've seen how it happens. And then it just spills into this extraordinary diversity of animal lives, small carnivores. The elephants come in. The king cobra is here, which means that there are other snakes here. There's, you know, 30 species of amphibians. So the plants seem to begin it, at least visually to me, that's what it seems. I can't see fungi with my naked eye, so maybe they were there before. So maybe it helps that this has such heavy rainfall, this area. So maybe the rain begins it. You know, nature is very kind here. So I don't know what actually initiates the process, but I can see the plants first.
So why, what is it? You know, you've written some beautiful pieces about this. What is it about? Help people who are listening to this interview to fall in love with plants if they haven't already. What are some of the things that you or other people at the sanctuary love so much about plants?
It's different. Okay, go ahead. What's the question?
Or what are some of the specific plants that you just think that you would like to introduce to people? Not introduce as in they have to have on their land, but that they don't know about.
Well, you know, I'm looking out right now at, I don't know, this several hundred species that I can see from this room. And what's magical right now are the impatiens, or do you refer to them as the impatiens in the
Yes.
United States? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So possibly the ones that you know there are, you'd consider them invasives. Is that right?
Or often, or sometimes people plant them intentionally in gardens.
Yeah. So those from my visits to the West, I've seen those tend to be the hybrid impatiens, very few species. And what I'm looking out on, or what's here in the sanctuary, there's over 100 species of impatiens that are native to these mountains. And they've come from, you know, all the way north in Maharashtra down to Kanyakumari. And they are, the thing about them is the way they're distributed all across the mountains. And most of them, they come out during the monsoon. And so we can almost locate a specific plateau. If you were to take me blindfolded and drop me in the middle somewhere and I see a particular impatient species, I would know where I am in the mountains. So they're very localized. Most of them are extremely localized to specific valleys or mountains or plateaus. And they are, I think they're technically called orophytes. And they just, you know, the colors with the backdrop of green and dark green right now, and the grays of the monsoon. And so you have to be very brave, and, you know, the leeches are also out at this time, but it's really the impatience time, and it's just the most beautiful sight that for me. And of course, the others who live here would want to say something about the ground orchids. There's over 100 ground orchids native to these mountains, or the legumes or the grasses and so on. So each of us has taken care or responsibility for specific groups of plants. And part of that is because, you know, plants within a specific genus might grow in a similar way, or, you know, the various tricks for helping them grow better are quite sort of common to specific, to each genus. So for me, the Western Ghats are almost like defined by the impatience. And yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that you use the word threats to plants. Can you talk about some of the threats in that region, or subcontinent, if you want, some of the threats to plants and to wildlife, including plants? What are some of the primary threats in the area? Not the local area, like within 50 miles, but that region of the world.
Okay, well, roughly 50% went with the colonial period, when the English, they cut and cleared forests for either logging, or, and then they planted tea and so on. So a lot of land was cleared, say about, you know, in the 1900s and so on, from 1850 on to about 1930 or so. And then another 40%. So we estimate something like 7% of the forests are left. And that's been a process of further clearing for urban settlements or small farms or hydroelectric power stations. That's a major threat. Exotic plantations. And now we're witnessing changes from invasive exotics. And a big one, which I think is worth talking about, is the extraction of plants for medicinal purposes for a global market. So we've witnessed how plants are just, you know, picked and ripped out for an increasingly, you know, it's sold, I think, in California, plants from here and all over the world, the Ayurvedic industry. And they say that 8,000 of the 16 or 17,000 plant species found in India are identified as medicinal. So that's like 1 in 2 to 3 plants are have some kind of medicinal property. And earlier it used to be people locally, treating in people in the village and so on, but now they just go everywhere. So, well, that's a major pressure of a different kind.
You know, something I wrote about in one of my books, is Endgame, I think, is that no population can survive global demand. And the example I use of that is, there was a person wrote me from Canada that there used to be a lot of grizzly bears in the valley where she lived, but then local hunters discovered the Chinese market for bear gallbladders. And so the point is that even something as seemingly esoteric as gallbladders, you know, there's no way that that valley could support that. So, you know, even if it's a fairly common plant, if everybody in the United States suddenly realizes or suddenly decides that they have to have a certain plant to cure their indigestion or to make it so they can get an erection, then, you know, it doesn't matter how common the plant is, it's going to go.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's really ignored in the medicinal plant business. And there was a big hype, I think 15 years ago or so, about how medicinal plant cultivation could be part of livelihood support and, you know, income generation for people in poor areas, and how we could have two or three things addressed at the same time if everyone planted medicinal plants and, you know, at least the commoner species. But factually, at least from what I've heard, if out of the 1,500 or 2,000 species they say that are used for human purposes from these mountains, less than 100 are cultivated. So that means everything else is coming from the wild. And when they were promoting these programs, all very well intentioned, they omitted to, they just didn't connect with the fact that all these plants require the environment. And it's like a mutual thing that you can't have a forest without these plants. You can't have these plants without their habitats. It's the way they grow in the rainforest, and you cannot make crops out of most of these plants, which are all, you know, they're all coming from these very diverse and very finely attuned environments. I know nothing about other ecologies, so I'm just speaking about this particular ecology here. So, you know, the way plants are distributed across the mountains, they're not in big stands in one place, but they're, you know, it's scattered. And they require other plants. So the tubers and the creepers and the herbaceous plants and the woody plants, and they all require each other. So if you try to extract from that and make a farm out of a medicinal plant that requires shade or a running stream or whatever, it's not going to work. And they have actually failed. They failed abysmally. And so most of the medicinal plants are still coming from the wild. And that's a major, major pressure. So next time anyone, you know, I always say or brush your teeth with toothpaste coming from India and it's good for you because it's herbal, please don't think it's good for the environment. And the second one is, even organic coffee or organic tea grown for a global market is absolutely, you know, it's still bad for the environment, for the forest.
So, you know, talking about collecting, you and I have spoken before about orchid collecting and how that has had, there has been some severe damage caused by that over the decades. Do you want to talk about orchids at all?
Well, orchid collection here was really restricted to a few species, but you know, the Victorians really specialized in that. And so they initiated this whole sort of, you know, passion for collection from all over the world. They took back to the to England all these, what they considered were curiosities. And often they would just, you know, they would send these adventurers and collectors to different places, which would just initiated this whole collector's mania. And that is still there, though it's not restricted to orchids. And of the orchids, the South Indian orchids are not considered to be of great ornamental or horticultural value, except for a few. So yes, there has been of the lady slipper orchid, it has been ripped out from the wild.
Well, or you mentioned collectors in general, and you know, the great auk. There are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere because they were slaughtered for oil and slaughtered for any number of reasons. They were incredibly common, great auks, and they were slaughtered. And then when there got to be not very many of them, the last bunches, many of those were killed by collectors who wanted the eggs for their collections. And
yeah.
We see this once again, not just with plants. I mean, you know, in my work, I focus a lot on like timber companies, on big dams, and that's really dreadful. But at the same time, one of the things that really bugs me, because it's so completely gratuitous, is like most of the tropical fish come from wild caught as opposed to captive raised. And we've all heard stories of, you know, like they'll see some, somebody will see some endangered lizard, and all of a sudden you have collectors coming in from all over to lift up every log in the forest trying to find more of those endangered lizards.
Yes. Yes, so they're collectors of different kinds. They're collectors who want, you know, body parts of specific animals, or I would, you know, also say body parts of trees. If you ring bark a tree for its resin, you're going to kill the tree. And there's demand for, you know, resins and so on. But that's one kind of collection. The other is the scientific exploration. And I know that we're quite cautious about we don't really share our specific finds with the world at large, partly because of collection issues, that because plants don't move, it's very easy to go and, you know, just pull them out by the roots and put them into a herbarium specimen, and then you then have to go through the scientific naming process. And all of this is to, you know, supposedly for the betterment of science, and so that we know the last of these plants before they disappear, but you've made them disappear in your, you know, knowledge search. So we have very good friends who are close botanists, who are very good botanists, who are close friends, who we will give a plant from, you know, what we've grown, and we know that they also, they're not, you know, part of this tribe of collectors. But there's a hunt on for frogs and for lizards, because they're finding more than, you know, have been previously described. And the same with the impatiens and so many other groups of plants, because there's still a lot that scientists haven't seen. So, you know, previously undescribed and newly discovered. And, you know, of course, people living here have known these, and they might not have named them, but they're known to communities living here. And it's such a race to put your name on this newly discovered species. And so we're losing, actually, I would say, large numbers of frogs and lizards, and there's a whole lizard family that's been found that I'm really horrified by this process of what is justified in the name of science. So they're not taken for breeding, for instance, and then from which you would then you know, work with one animal or one plant or whatever. They're actually killed outright.
Yeah, I just today saw an article about how, oh, I don't remember what it was, like, butterfly collectors are gathering DNA with their nets. It's like, no, they're actually killing butterflies.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not collecting DNA. But anyway, I want to go back to, we have like, oh, I don't know, 15 minutes left, and I want to go, you know, you talked about, I want to talk about some of the, okay, so you bring in plants from, you know, a trash heap or from a place that's about to be destroyed, which, I mean, you have the sanctuary, and the image that kept coming to mind was like after World War II, there were all these displaced person camps, all over parts of Europe, and refugee camps now all over. And it seems to me that that's part of what you're doing, is having this camp where the plants can go from certain death to, as you've said, a sanctuary. And then part of the ultimate goal is to help them establish a toehold somewhere. So can you talk about some of the, without giving details that would make it so collectors could go grab them, can you talk about some of the success stories of the sanctuary over the last 40 years?
Oh, so many. And that's the pleasure and the beauty of this work. And You know, for me, it's the sign of hope, really, in a world that's just completely, completely being destroyed. So the images that we use is really, if, you know, in Hiroshima, if somebody found a child or a puppy after the bomb was dropped, you know, and would you not bring the child home? And so that's what we've done. We've done precisely that for 2,000 plant species over a mountain range, which is 93% gone. And of course, the 93% have to be brought back, but somebody in the meantime, somebody has to do this work. And Lali and Suma and Purvi, who are all looking at different groups of plants, have, you know, they go all over the mountains looking for impatiens, and, you know, it could be a quarry, for instance. There's a very rare orchid that we have seen 3 times, that one collection was made from a quarry. We brought that home, and it's now all over the sanctuary here. And so then we have other friends who are in another part of the mountains, and we know that this plant was reported from there. So what we did was, when we had, you know, propagated many of them here, we then took them to these friends who are working on restoration projects over there, and that was then reintroduced into the wild where it was believed to be extinct. So that's kind of the full cycle of that particular orchid, which, you know, we've seen maybe a total of 50 or 60 individuals in the wild.
And does anybody, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, wildlife rehabilitation. When they release the creatures, a lot of times they don't see them again. Do people ever go back to the areas, you know, 10 years later and see, wow, the plant has reproduced and now there's 17 instead of 3?
Well, we, you know, the reintroduction is, I would say, we're just about to begin it seriously. So with these particular friends, yes, they would know. They would know what's happened to every single plant that's been planted out, because they work like we do with that kind of attentiveness and detail. But elsewhere, where we, for instance, we took this really rare fern, and my first experience with the importance of this work was actually, we'd been looking for this fern for days. In fact, I think it, we'd been looking for years. We were in a particular valley, and we were, driving through and then walking through and then climbing. And then I think several days later, we found this valley that was burning, and we decided to proceed. And then we actually found one of these tree ferns in the middle of this burning area, and somehow it was just miraculously alive. So we brought it back, and that's when I realized, my goodness, you know, this work is really, really, really important. And the fern is now all over the garden, all over the sanctuary. And then we took it, a whole bunch of them, we took them to 2 different places. So one set survived because they were under the direct care of some people we know, and the other was in the national park, where they actually did not survive. So we hope to initiate this next year with many more species, because we now have people who we know can follow them in the way that we do. But no one has done that, you know, in India to great success because of the follow-up issues.
You know, one of the things that frustrates me about my own work and my own career, or the reception to my work, is that because I say that we need to use any means necessary to stop this culture from killing the planet, that sometimes people just perceive that as code language for violence. But that's really frustrating to me, because that's not true. Sure, we may have to, violence may be part of it, but that's not the point. The point is that we need everything, including people doing. I mean, this whole interview, I've been on the verge of tears.
Me too. Just describing this to, you know, to people somewhere else is just brings the meaning of it so alive for me. How precious these plants are, and how no one sees that, really, you know. And yet here we are, we're just surrounded by them and they just so want to live. They want this extra chance. And why are they cooperating with us? And so.
And this is something that anyone can participate in no matter where they live. I mean, probably someone could do some version of this even in a city.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I was just saying that, so tell me how somebody could do it in a city.
Well, every city, as you know, you've addressed in your work, and as we all know, is a place where plants and animals have lived and were destroyed. And I have a lot of friends in different cities who have explored what that landscape should be. And what they do is they offer little refuges on terraces or on, you know, their gardens or in city parks and so on. So there are a lot of naturalists out there who are actually working with bringing whoever belonged there back. And cultivation is an ancient thing. You know, it's not the same as farming and agriculture, but in this landscape, which has such high human pressure, the great thing about it is that the people of the state are really, they're just natural cultivators. They belong here because they have, like in the Amazon, you know, they have grown plants and they live under them. And so it's possible. Plants do want that. And it's not a question of playing God at all. It's just that it's the absolutely reciprocal relationship between human beings and growing plants, and then through whom the animals come back. So anybody anywhere can plant seeds or cuttings or bring a little bit of greenery back and offer refuges anywhere in the world. And it must be done, because the way climate is changing is going really crazy. We need to do these things that assist, give this additional chance. So if, for instance, we're seeing temperatures change or the monsoon pattern change, and if we weren't here, these plants might actually be dead in the wild. So we're able to do these things like water them when it's too dry, or make additional cuttings, or take them to the higher elevation. So I think it's necessary.
And the distinction that you have drawn, there's a distinction though between what you're saying and what a lot of the neo-environmentalists say, who believe that the world is a big garden that we're supposed to play with however we want. Oh. And just to be clear, I mean, what is the difference? And I know there's a difference, but what is the difference between what you're saying and what they're saying about how humans run the show now, and we need to just acknowledge that and run it as we see fit?
Oh, I'm, it's almost like a diametrical opposite. I mean, the world is wild and the plants are wild and the forest is wild. It's there. They're all there because, I mean, they're there. And, it's like writing. I think we use the specific tools or gifts that we have to serve the wild. So we're talking about using all our sensibilities and capacities, and the people I live with are genius gardeners. But what they're doing is they're constantly listening to the plants and serving them. So I think it's not that the world is, we don't say that the world is a garden. We say the world is wild, and we as gardeners can serve the wild. That's what we're saying. Is that?
Oh, that's beautiful. And I know this is a huge topic, but you said the plants will talk to them, and you and I have talked before, and we're not talking as scientists. We're just talking as plant lovers here. You and I have talked before about plants. Every cell on a plant is really a photoreceptor. And that's just you and I have had a conversation about wow, so do plants see with their leaves? And I'm not saying we need to go in that sort of very mind-blowing direction, but you did say that the plants talk to them. What do you mean?
Well,
and I'm completely with you. You know, I'm completely with you on this.
Yes. And it's so refreshing to be able to just speak openly about this. You know, if we couldn't put Latin names, if Lali and Suma and Purvi couldn't put Latin names on 2000 species of native plants, they would be considered as just, you know, like, airy fairy, new agey, or, you know, whatever. But, every single one of them would say, and I believe it, that the plants are actually, they are showing and communicating and telling them what needs to be done. And it's because they are telling them what needs to be done that they know. It's not, and the secret and the evidence for that is no one else in this country is growing as many species as Lali, Suma, and Purvi are. And that's because they say the plants are telling them what to do. And, you know, each one has a different way of understanding or receiving this information. And I think some people are more feeling, like literally in their skin. Others are more visual. And Lali gets, for instance, idea. She says she gets such a brilliant new idea. It's not something that she could have thought of. It's not her idea. It's come from somewhere. And then she knows exactly what to do for this plant. And the plant is happy or sets flowers or seeds or whatever. So each of us seems to receive information, messages, signals, and we make sense of it in different ways. And I would say the evidence that something's working or something's transpiring between all of us is just the happiness of the plants. And
I think, you know, maybe we should do another interview sometime that's just about that. But we only have like a minute left, and I have two questions, so we'll try to go real fast on these, even though they're huge questions. One of them is, it's necessary for people to do the sort of work that you're doing and to do that to make these refuges everywhere for plants, animals, amphibians, fungi, it doesn't matter, you know? And then in addition, you've also written about how that's not sufficient. There are people who say, great, let's just garden and then forget everything else. But we also have to stop the primary damage, right?
Absolutely.
And is there anything you want to say about that besides absolutely, or you want to just let's take it as a given?
Well, that's a huge subject, but you know, we're gardeners and educators and you know, plant rehabilitators or whatever, but I'm personally connected to just so many people around the country who are, you know, who are really doing what they can do to stop the system in its tracks or bring it down, even if it's local.
See, this is so important because the permaculture wing in the United States, there are some of them who are ready for resistance too, and then others who say resistance isn't necessary. But that's one of the things I love about your work is that you recognize the importance of all these facets.
Well, you know, I stood in a human chain here in the neighborhood against a dam that was projected for our area, and the sanctuary would have been submerged. And so it worked in that particular instance. We didn't just stand in a chain. We did all kinds of other things, and the church actually organized the resistance at that point. So that worked in that instance, and there are other people doing other things, and not enough is being done. More needs to be done.
So my last question is, I guess there's once again, two questions. One of them is, what do you want people to do? I guess the first question is, how can people support the sanctuary? What do you want them to do? Can they go to a website? What do you want them to do? Second thing is, what do you want people to do in general, having heard this interview, for the world?
Well, any specific things they might want to know about our work, you could write to me at jungler@gmail.com, or I mean, there's information on the website at www.gbsanctuary.org. So that's welcome. And then the other is, you know, we need to defend or grow or cultivate or do whatever it is we're doing with all our lives. With, you know, it's the world's at stake. These plants are at stake, and we've given our entire lives over to them. There's nothing else that we're doing. Everything's at stake at this point.
Well, thank you so much for the interview, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Supi Seshan. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.